The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KUCI, its management, the UC Board of Regents, or Palestinian DJ Sama Abdulladi. Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the March 9th, 2021 edition of Ask a Leader. Today is the election for the Orange County Board of Supervisors 2nd District. If you reside therein or know someone who does, be sure to turn out. These elections matter, listeners. Today, my first guest is UCI Mind Director Dr. Josh Grill. He's going to take some deep dives into promising findings in clinical trials for medications treating Alzheimer's disease. In the second segment, Voice of OC reporter Brandon Foe talks from his recent article about hate crimes directed toward Asian Americans in Orange County. Let's start this show right away. My first guest is Dr. Joshua Grill, director of UCI Mind, that's the Institute for Memory Impairment and Neurological Disorders, here to talk about the clinical findings in the FDA having extended aducanumab trials. He's the director of UCI Mind and associate director of UCI's Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Josh Grill focuses his research on clinical trials across the spectrum of Alzheimer's disease. He comes to us today from his office in Irvine. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, Dr. Joshua Grill.
Thank you for having me, Claudia.
Well, I checked back in my little records. You were here 6 years ago, almost to the week, to talk about this anti-amyloid treatment in asymptomatic Alzheimer's study. It's still the same study that's getting this extension, correct?
No, the anti-amyloid treatment in asymptomatic Alzheimer's disease, or A4 study, is still ongoing, actually.
Okay.
That is a different type of study. It's a study that was enrolling people who were older but cognitively normal.
That's asymptomatic, yes.
Asymptomatic, and testing whether a different monoclonal antibody against the beta amyloid protein that accumulates in the brain of people with Alzheimer's disease could actually prevent or delay the onset of memory problems in people who are deemed at increased risk to develop them because PET scans suggested that amyloid might be accumulating in their brain. Aducanumab, which I think we'll talk mostly about today, is a different monoclonal antibody drug, one that has been tested in a handful of clinical trials, including 2 phase 3 registration trials that the FDA is considering now. And those trials enrolled people who have Alzheimer's disease and have memory problems, meet the criteria for mild cognitive impairment or mild Alzheimer's dementia, and were enrolled because of their symptoms. And as you point out, the FDA is currently considering the data that the sponsor of those clinical trials, Biogen, has submitted for potential approval of aducanumab. They also convened an advisory panel toward the end of last year. And the trials are done, but what has been extended is the timeline that the FDA is using to decide whether to approve aducanumab as potentially the first ever disease-modifying therapy for Alzheimer's disease. If they choose to do that, the drug would almost certainly be approved for people who match the conditions that were included in the clinical trial, specifically people who have demonstrable memory problems leading to a diagnosis of MCI or mild dementia.
So, Josh Grill, when you say it's the first disease-modifying drug, so that we understand what that means in terms of cure, managing, forestalling, progression, what does that range cover?
Yeah, it's an important question. So the FDA has previously approved 5 treatments for Alzheimer's disease, and all 5 are, of course, unique and had clinical trials to suggest that they could help patients with this disease. But all 5 are what we would call symptomatic treatments. They range in their approvals from mild to moderate to even severe Alzheimer's disease. But when a person takes those drugs, they do a little better on cognitive tests and even functional tests than they would if they weren't taking the drug. Or, you know, in the case of the clinical trials, people who got the drug compared to people who got placebo, performed a little better on memory tests and functional tests. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive disease, meaning that though it may differ from one person to the next, we expect a person with this disease to get worse over time in their cognitive performance and in the amount of help they need to live their life. And those five FDA-approved drugs don't really change the rate of disease progression, meaning that regardless of whether a person is taking any of those drugs, we expect that they will get worse over time and that the drug's presence or absence won't really impact the rate at which they get worse. With the drug that's being considered by the FDA now and with a number of drugs that are under development, the goal is really different. The goal is to try to slow the course of the disease, hopefully stop the progression of the disease.
Actually stop.
Perhaps someday, or even perhaps someday to reverse the course of the disease. With aducanumab, the data that have been presented to the FDA and the case that the company Biogen is trying to make is that they can slow the rate of progression, that people who got aducanumab compared to people who got placebo got worse more slowly. The data are not convincing to say that aducanumab can stop the progression of Alzheimer's disease, let alone reverse it. But the field will sort of need to crawl before we walk. And slowing the disease would be a tremendously meaningful milestone for the field if we had a drug that could actually slow the progression of the disease. And of course, with such drugs, early diagnosis would become even more important and perhaps even preceding the onset of memory problems would be when these drugs could have the greatest benefit.
So first, I want to talk about the progression. And I don't know if this is too particular to be able to respond to, but the progressions can take the shape, the graph of like a stepwise, like a it's like a drop, a decline, and then a plateau, and then a decline, I mean, like stepwise versus like a slope. So have you seen in the research that the progression has adapted both of those kinds of declines, those shapes?
Well, we really think of Alzheimer's disease as a disease associated with a more slow progression over time, a slope, if you will.
Okay, slope.
And a staircase progression, one where a person seems really stable for some time and then suddenly experiences a drop and then it remains stable for some time. We don't really think of that as the typical course of progression for Alzheimer's disease. Other problems like vascular cognitive impairment, where a person is experiencing small or large strokes and that impairs their cognition and their ability to function, that may have more of a staircase-like progression. But with Alzheimer's disease, certainly there are exceptions. If a person with Alzheimer's disease experiences some other medical trauma, like a stroke.
Or like surgery, right?
Surgery, there's mixed data about whether surgery and general anesthesia actually produces precipitous declines in cognitive or functional performance. But certainly anecdotally, many of us know people who have a loved one with Alzheimer's disease, and they will tell stories about how much worse things got after mom's surgery or after dad died or other sad stories like that. And so those are certainly real experiences. But when we look at the studies of large populations of people who are followed over long periods of time, we do really think that this disease looks more like a slow and relatively steady decline over time. Now, of course, the goal of these drugs is to try to change that line, that slope. And in fact, that's, how a lot of these trials get analyzed. Can we change the slope of the line when we measure memory performance over the course of a trial? Do the people who get drug have a less decline, a less slope on the line that measures their serial performance on cognitive tests? And the data for aducanumab, I think it's fair to say, are mixed, but somewhat suggestive that if aducanumab is given to people at high enough dose for long enough periods of time, perhaps aducanumab can slow the course of that line. Whether the data that they have in hand will be adequate for FDA approval remains to be seen.
And can you isolate the trend of whether the earlier the aducanumab was administered to a mild cognitive impaired person, the sooner it was administered, perhaps the different shape of a slope, or is that that's too particular too?
No, actually, that's one of the really perplexing things about the data for aducanumab that have been presented to the FDA and analyzed by the FDA and are now publicly available as a result of the advisory panel that was convened, is that secondary analyses of the data, and I can kind of explain all the data.
Yes.
So, you know, the story for aducanumab is that it is a complicated story. They had very exciting and compelling data in a phase 1b study that was published in the illustrious journal Nature, whereby it was discovered that this drug, aducanumab, could essentially clear the brain of the amyloid plaques that accumulate in Alzheimer's disease. And that was very exciting.
Yeah.
There was also a hint towards a dose response, meaning that the more drug someone got, the more the plaques were removed. Great, wonderful. And a suggestion, and one of the first in our history, that the more drug a person got, the more the plaques were removed, and the less they progressed in their Alzheimer's disease clinical and functional symptoms. And that was extremely noteworthy, perhaps the most exciting thing about the data. It wasn't perfect data, but still, to suggest that the more the drug cleared the plaques of the brain, the more the patients benefited clinically was really monumental. From that 1B study, the sponsor Biogen decided to advance immediately into two simultaneous large multinational multi-site parallel clinical trials to test the efficacy of aducanumab. Could they get enough data to get FDA approval that aducanumab was a meaningful treatment for people with Alzheimer's disease? Those two trials encountered some challenges. They really weren't quite ready to dose patients in those trials, meaning that there was still some data analysis ongoing, and they would ultimately amend the trials while they were underway to increase the dose that a particular subset of patients were allowed to receive during the trial. They also had planned what we call interim analyses, an effort to decide before the trials are done whether they're likely to achieve their ultimate goal and preserve resources if there's no reason to continue the studies. And that includes, you know, the company's resources. These are expensive trials to undertake, but also the human resources of people who are participating, which is absolutely the most valuable resource in our field.
Right.
You don't want to expose people to risk unnecessarily. If the drug's not going to work, perhaps those folks could be in other trials, et cetera. So a very long story made somewhat shorter. The trials were actually stopped because the interim analyses suggested that they were unlikely to meet their primary endpoint. So that was very disappointing to all of us in the field. It was a bit surprising to some, but not all in the field. I'll admit to being surprising to me, given how promising those early phase one results were. Subsequently, after halting the trials, halting trials is a process unto itself. And
there's data in halting a trial.
There's data in the halting of trials. And there's data that accumulates in the period between making a data freeze to do an interim analysis and even making the decision to halt the trials. And so sometime later, after halting the trials based on this interim analysis, Biogen announced that they had continued to analyze the data and had analyzed the data that came in subsequent to that data freeze, and that to their surprise, the data were actually suggestive that the drug worked. And so you can see why this is a very complicated story.
It's whipsawing.
It is.
Oh my goodness.
And so they then announced that they were, you know, intent to present these data publicly, which they did last December, and that they were going to submit the data to the FDA for a potential approval. To get to your to the question that you asked that barked that long story, the FDA has completed their own data analyses. And again, the results are very mixed and complex. But one of the really kind of confusing results is that many of us would have hypothesized that if the drug was going to work for some but not other patients, it might work best in people who are mildest in their disease and or mildest in the severity of their neurodegeneration and pathology. And in fact, that wasn't the case, that the FDA analyses suggested that the patients who might benefit most were actually the patients with dementia, not the patients with MCI. In
fact, more advanced progression of Alzheimer's. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And so that's confusing and difficult to understand, and will really require more studies and more analyses. And I hope that those studies happen and that we get the opportunity to better understand these results.
Well, that would raise then a concern, because what UCI Mind, and I'm sure other research centers around the country and the world, are about responding early. You're doing genetic testing for, you're looking for the presence of mild cognitive impairment. You're looking for early signs. And that's, you want the public to respond sooner than culturally people are necessarily ready to respond to any kind of form of brain degeneration. And so that's a problem for you. And I also wanted to find out what the one thing that I hadn't heard yet was, as the drug dose increased, what were the side effects of that drug? And did it matter what the age of the participant was?
Yeah. So that's a lot. Let me try to take those in turn. First, I should say that, you know, the studies did not set out to test whether aducanumab worked differently in people with MCI versus people with dementia. So we have to take those sort of secondary analytic results with a grain of salt, because that wasn't the point of the study. The point of the study was to test whether aducanumab worked better than placebo.
Right.
And again, we've got some mixed results. In fact, one of the trials was deemed positive, i.e. it showed a benefit of, mm-hmm. of aducanumab versus placebo, while the other one was deemed negative. It did not show that benefit. But then the case being made to the FDA really relies upon that in that negative trial, the folks who got the highest dose of aducanumab for the full duration of the study showed a benefit. But that's a complex undertaking unto itself. So again, we're still waiting to hear what the FDA is going to say about possibility of approving based on the data that are currently available.
The side effects.
Yeah, the side effects are very real. All of the anti-amyloid drugs, at least the ones that seem to have the ability to clear the brain of the amyloid plaques, but perhaps even some that don't do that, have one notable side effect that we call amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, or ARIA, A-R-I-A. And most of my clinician colleagues who are doing these trials feel that this is a real but manageable side effect. And the different drugs have different rates of these side effects. And it's also worth noting that there are particular risk factors for experiencing the side effects of ARIA, most notably one particular genetic test. In the aducanumab studies, among the people who carry that genetic risk factor, the rates of ARIA were quite high, approaching the high 30% of people who have that genetic risk factor and got aducanumab, the active treatment. A large portion of them, not a majority, but certainly, but a large portion of them experienced ARIA. Now, the good news is that most of the time, if ARIA happens, it has no side effect, no clinical presentation whatsoever. It's something that we observe on an MRI scan and know that it's happening, but the patient wouldn't otherwise know. They don't experience any symptoms as a result of the side effect. If symptoms do occur, it can present as dizziness or confusion or worsening of memory performance, for example. And there are rare occurrences of more serious clinical effects of ARIA, and that can look more like a stroke. But thankfully, those seem to be rare. And the majority of cases, and this is true for all of the monoclonal antibodies that cause ARIA, the majority of cases seem to be both asymptomatic and resolve over time. So the typical occurrence is to simply stop giving the drug to people who experience ARIA, and the ARIA will go away on its own. There's even some examples of cases of people who had ARIA. It was missed in some other studies of other monoclonal antibodies. They kept getting the treatment and the ARIA still went away without causing symptoms. So it's an area of active research, largely with the notion that if any of these drugs are going to get approved for clinical use, we're going to have to really understand how to best manage these side effects. So most of my clinical colleagues feel that those side effects are real, that expert clinicians who will end up using these drugs for their patients with memory problems due to Alzheimer's disease will be able to manage those side effects accordingly.
For those of you who've just joined us, you're tuned in to Ask a Leader here on 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Dr. Joshua Grill, the UCI MIND director, talking about some promising results of an Alzheimer's drug in clinical trial. It's aducanumab. And I wanted to ask whether what the gene you're talking, is that the APOE4, the APOE gene? Is that the one, or is it a different gene that you're saying?
You're correct. It's the APOE gene, the apolipoprotein E gene. The APOE gene is long now known to have an impact on an individual's risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. It is not determinant. Testing an APOE genotype doesn't tell a person whether they will or will not someday get Alzheimer's disease, but people who carry a particular flavor of the APOE gene, what we call E4, are at greater risk than people who don't carry E4. And people who carry a different flavor, E2, may be at a little bit lower risk than people who don't carry in E2. But E3 is the most common form, and most people are what we call E3, because like all genes, we get one copy from mom and one copy from dad. So if we get a E4 allele from either mom or dad, our risk of getting Alzheimer's disease is greater than if we didn't. And in these trials, people who carry E4 are more likely to experience ARIA as a side effect of these drugs. And in fact, this is the source of some of the complexities of the story for aducanumab. The concern was whether people who carried an E4 genotype could be given the highest dose of aducanumab. And ultimately, it was determined that they could. Okay. But the time it took to determine that, and then the fact that the protocol began prior to that, really resulted in the uniqueness of the negative trial in particular, whereby the company says, you know, not enough people had gotten the high dose in that arm at the time of the interim analysis. But then data kept coming in from people who had, and those were the people who demonstrated the benefit of the drug.
So the equity is always on our minds. It's increasingly on our minds as we're watching the pandemic unfold. And I wanted to know, I mean, we are only entering now in what is known as the phase 4 post-marketing surveillance study. That's the phase that this trial has moved into, correct?
No, the trial is gonna try to bring back people who are in the phase 3 studies for an extension study, but we're definitely not in phase 4 because we don't yet know if the FDA is going to approve aducanumab, and we're expecting that decision now sometime in June.
In June, okay.
And only then would there potentially be phase 4 types of studies or post-marketing surveillance. You know, that's much more about safety than efficacy. And it's very hard to deduce measures of efficacy in post-approval studies because you lose that critical control group that you have.
Oh my goodness. So that's where we're not going to know about the APOE sort of breakdown either.
Well, we have learned a little bit about the APOE impact from the sponsor in their presentations and certainly from the FDA analysis. And I expect we'll learn more about the data that are available over time. The million-dollar question is, what's the FDA going to do? And mm-hmm. if they approve the drug, then our ability to learn more about these important questions will be greatly reduced. If they don't approve the drug, hopefully that'll spur the company to do more trials to achieve approval, and all the more opportunity in a controlled setting to learn about both efficacy and safety.
So I guess it's a hypothetical then, if it's at that phase right now, that at that fork in the road, is whether aducanumab would be available to anyone who would ask for it. Or do you imagine, Josh, that the cost of this pharmaceutical is going to be really expensive. It may be kind of a, you know, there will be limited access by virtue of its expense. You'd have to have insurance, and your insurance has to approve this as being no longer a, what they call, the classification is a treatment under research.
Yeah, if the FDA approves aducanumab, that's going to spark a whole slew of additional questions. What's the indication for the drug going to look like? Presumably it would be extremely similar to the relatively narrow criteria that were used in the clinical trials. Regardless of what that label says, you know, whether payers are going to reimburse for aducanumab is going to be a very interesting question. And this complex story that will have led to its approval could factor in. We just don't know yet. And I don't know how much the cost will be for aducanumab, but the numbers that I've heard are certainly not insignificant. And so I think it's fair to say that most families who have a loved one with Alzheimer's disease in this country would not likely be able to afford aducanumab if insurance isn't going to pay for it. And that will spark a number of other important questions and discussions, but only time will answer those questions.
So has the trial, it was put on hold. So there isn't currently at UCI Mind, is there, there is no aducanumab trial.
There are no ongoing trials of aducanumab that are open to enrollment, as I understand it at this very moment. The company was trying to bring back people who were in the previous studies.
Because they're super valuable.
They are extremely valuable, and they will be for a very long time. And you know, our field actually has a very important history in trying to study people who were enrolled in clinical trials long after the trial has ended. For example, you know, some really fundamental discoveries were made from people who participated in the first ever vaccine trials, which were, you know, 20 years ago now. And those folks were followed in many cases for the remainder of their lives and even donated their brains for autopsy research. And this was at a time where we had far fewer tools to study these things during life. For example, PET scans that show us the presence of amyloid plaques. So those people participating and donating their brain to autopsy is how we first learned that some of these immunotherapy approaches could actually clear the brain of plaques. And that was tremendously important to help us get us to where we are now, which is hopefully on the cusp of having, you know, meaningful treatments to offer patients for these diseases. I do feel like we are on the cusp of that. I don't know whether FDA will approve aducanumab, but I
really don't. This is really, it's a big question.
It's a big question.
This is leading edge, Josh. This is exciting.
That's why we do what we do. We want to be a part of the leading edge, and we want to learn and accelerate our learning so that we can improve what we have to offer families who are dealing with these very difficult diseases. And of course, there's tremendous public health impact of Alzheimer's disease and other causes of dementia. And we, you know, I'm really fortunate to be a part of such an incredible organization with many, many faculty from all over UCI's campuses who want to come together to try to do something about this through collaborative, transdisciplinary, and synergistic research. And I really do think we've been learning at an extremely high rate over the last decade or two. And I think we're going to see changes in the way we talk about, think about, and treat Alzheimer's disease and other dementias in the next 5 years.
So the last question, and unfortunately it's a big one, maybe not, is can you gauge the change in culture of a patient, a participant, and a participant's family members, loved ones, in their receptivity and willingness to take various genetic screenings that are going to tell them more than they can necessarily handle? This is something you've been involved with for many years at UCI Mind and previously when you were at UCLA. But is there a change in people facing down their sort of genetic history that might say a lot about where their senior years are going?
No, I don't think it's changed a lot. I think, you know, studies going back decades now support that many people want information about their own future. Certainly there are some who don't, but I would say that the majority of people who are asked say that they'd rather know than not know.
And that's been a constant, or is it, I'm just wondering if it's changing, if more and more people are really wanting to know.
No, I think it's been relatively constant. And, you know, our ability to study this and the reality of our ability to provide any sort of prognostic information has obviously changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Where we've, you know, moved from asking pretty purely hypothetical questions to now asking much more tangible questions. Now, we still cannot predict who will and will not develop Alzheimer's disease in their later years. But we do have new tools, and we've been studying the impact of doing these types of tests and sharing that information with people. And again, most of our findings and the findings from the field say that one, you know, a fair number of people really do want to have this information. Two, that they understand what we can and most importantly, what we cannot tell people, i.e. that we can't give them 100% certainty around what their future holds, but we can give them information about whether their risk is higher or lower in some cases. And three, that they can handle that information. Human beings are very resilient. We've, of course, been very careful in our approach to this. And so studies in which we share that type of information implement a pretty rigorous and, dare I say, cautious approach to make sure that people are equipped and ready to receive this information, to make sure that we're doing it in a safe way, and to make sure that they're okay after the fact. And yeah, overwhelmingly, the studies that have done that for genetic as well as now biomarker information have found that we can give people this information safely. We still, for the most part, feel like there needs to be unique circumstances to do it. You know, we don't go out and give PET scans willy-nilly to people who just want to know whether they do or don't have amyloid accumulating in their brain. And we do it in very specific situations as it relates to our research goals. But I am heartened that we've been able to do this in some cases at relatively large scale in multi-site studies, and that we've been able to do it safely. And of course, there's still a lot of questions to be answered, and we're eager to try to do that here at UCI Mind and have new studies that we'll be doing in the coming year or two that'll, I hope, answer some really important questions, including the issue of diversity. Most of our studies have overwhelmingly done this in non-Hispanic, white, highly educated populations. And Alzheimer's is a disease that affects every race and ethnicity. And so we need more data to better understand all of these issues, ranging from the effects of aducanumab to the effects of telling someone their genes and biomarkers in much more diverse populations. And we at UCI Mind are very committed to achieving those goals.
Well, that's an important charter. And if there's anything community radio can do to amplify that outreach, you know how to get a hold of us. Josh Grimm.
Well, I would love for your listeners to join us in this fight. There are two endeavors that are ongoing that anyone who's listening might be able to consider. One is that we've created a new tool at UC Irvine called the Consent to Contact Registry, or C2C Registry, that can be accessed on the web at c2c.uci.edu. And this is what I like to call a dating service, where
right.
People who are interested in research can enroll safely, free of charge, confidentially. And if a study is right for them that fits their goals, we can try to match them to that study. And we've actually recently translated the C2C into Spanish, Mandarin, Korean, and Vietnamese, because we are committed to engaging each of those diverse communities in our research. And then similarly, I'm part of a project with folks at UCSF and UC Davis to try to create a California registry of 10,000 older Asian American and Pacific Islanders, similarly available in a number of languages, in an effort to increase representation of those communities in research here at UCI and well beyond UCI.
In San Francisco Bay Area and in Davis.
And beyond there as well.
Okay.
And that's called the CARE Registry. And if you're an Asian American or Pacific Islander interested in that, you can Google CARE, but it's at careregistry.ucsf.edu. So we're part of both of those projects. We're actually trying to intermingle them to some extent because increasing Asian representation is important to research broadly. But here in Orange County, we've got a very diverse community of Asians, Pacific Islanders, and Hispanics. So these are long-term commitments that we've made at UCI for many years now and will continue to remain top of mind. Of course, partnering with communities has been more difficult during the pandemic, but we haven't let that stop us. And we are really excited and eager to come out of the pandemic, see people get vaccinated, see our own folks get vaccinated and get back into the community to try to let people know that we're all in this together and yes. We'll only succeed when we have true and meaningful partnerships.
Well, I'm going to, Josh Grill, put in the podcast summary, a link to when I had the registry. I did an interview about that before the pandemic. So you've been really generous with your time. Dr. Joshua Grill, thank you for being on Ask a Leader today.
Thank you for having me.
My guest was Dr. Joshua Grill, UCI Mind Director. That's UCI Institute for Memory Impairment and Neurological Disorders, talking today about where the aducanumab trials are progressing, the stage that they're in at this point. Thanks again, Joshua Grill.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with Brandon Foe, reporter with The Voice of OC, covering the vitriol directed toward Asian Americans in Orange County during this COVID pandemic. Don't go away. Welcome back to the show. My next guest is Brandon Foe, Voice of OC reporter and core member at Report for America, a ground truth initiative. Brandon covers North Central Orange County, as well as broader regional issues around law enforcement, transportation, the environment, the OC Fair, and Little Saigon. He joined the online newspaper as an intern. Now we see him doing fine work, breaking important stories for an important media platform. Most recently, he's put out a number of investigative stories, including the Poseidon desalination plant, which we're covering over on Digging Out, and we'll continue to watch that. And he's narrated a racial reckoning inside one of Orange County's largest school districts and tracked various quality of life issues across the region. Prior to joining Voice of OC, Brandon's worked as a reporter and editor at Cal State Fullerton's independent student newspaper, The Daily Titan. Won a number of accolades with the Los Angeles Press Club and the National College Media Association. Brandon's currently a member of Report for America, a national network of local reporters. Brandon comes to us today from his home in Rancho Santa Margarita. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Brandon Foe.
Hi, thank you.
Well, you just sent out an article this week. I'm recording this, folks, on March 6th. An article about some of the venal receptions they're some of them very violent outbursts towards anyone, a member of the Asian American Pacific Islander community. So are there particular areas in Orange County? Are there institutional settings? Are there particular communities that concern you as a reporter covering this, Brandon?
Right. Well, I can say that a large slice of Orange County's Asian American community consists of Vietnamese Americans. So if you're looking at or looking for particular areas where you would see controversy over anti-Asian hate, often it's going to be at those centers like Little Saigon, where you do see large portions of the population coalesced around. So for instance, over the last year, we've seen as many as 6 Buddhist temples vandalized in that Little Saigon area. That's not to say, though, that hate obviously does not just occur where the largest portion of this non-white population, you know, exists. It's also in South Orange County.
Like your article talked about Ladera Ranch.
Right. Yeah. So what happened in Ladera was this family had, you know, home security camera footage that showed kids doing things like leaving things on their doorstep, throwing things, and it was perceived as anti-Asian hate. And what ended up happening was, you know, the neighbors in that area started taking shifts to keep watch outside their home. So to many, it's just the latest showcase of, you know, what has been a longstanding issue in Orange County where it pertains to Asian American prejudiced xenophobia specifically centered on that population. Obviously, Orange County does have a history of discrimination and hate toward other groups, but as we're talking about the coronavirus and how the coronavirus has sort of fueled feelings of fear and scapegoating on the Asian American community, you obviously we've seen a lot of that across the country, not just in Orange County, but in Orange County specifically. These are these areas that we've seen that happen.
So I guess I'm asking maybe your personal experience. Does it seem like, yes, it's a cosmopolitan setting, but no, it just sometimes it goes right back to a 1950s feel, even though you were not around in the 1950s. But does it feel like it's a sort of a little whipsaw kind of a way of being in this county that it sort of tricks one into thinking we've made progress, but no, not really. I mean, what's it like for you?
Well, I think part of that can be attributed to the fact that Orange County throughout its history has continued to change from a demographic standpoint. In the early influx of Vietnamese American immigrants from, following the Vietnam War.
In the 1970s.
Right. When you started to see Vietnamese Americans trickle into the United States and set up these community centers that would later turn into, some of the largest concentrations of Vietnamese Americans or Vietnamese people outside of Vietnam, like Westminster, California. I was told when I was, talking to Tracy Law, who is the co-founder of VietRise, the local Vietnamese American immigrants advocacy group, she described to me, get back at the time, Vietnamese Americans were coming to Orange County in Westminster, city officials there, vocalized their opposition to that. There was rampant, xenophobia in that area around the time that they were settling in. Over the years, as Orange County becomes more non-white or as more non-white people become more visible in Orange County, you will likely see to people who, don't like that, you will likely see some friction, some tension, more controversies like hate crimes or hate incidents like the Buddhist temple vandalisms, happen as Orange County reckons with the fact that it is changing as a region. That's an observation that people have described to me throughout the years of my reporting on, non-white communities in Orange County is as Orange County understands and it sinks in that, it's not going, there are some places in the county that are not going to be bastions of white people, wealthy suburbanites. It's going to change as people move in and as regional economic forces, move people around.
So it's sort of like demographic growing pains.
Totally.
Like that. So, Brandon, what would you consider is the role or what are opportunities that could have been taken, assess the opportunities taken of the local leadership? I'm thinking of the Board of Supervisors, the district attorney, in setting examples, sort of trying to kind of raise the culture of a cosmopolitan culture versus sort of there's a kind of I see a red meat kind of a playbook where playing up, stoking certain kind of culture wars, but that's like a kind of partisan culture war, not raising the kind of cosmopolitan culture.
Well, I can say that something that took a big focus in my story in the latter half specifically was the observation that anytime we saw instances of hate, visible instances of discrimination against the Asian American community, for example, it's been met with swift condemnation. A lot of local officials are quick to say, this is wrong. This is unacceptable with news conferences. They stand up in front of a podium. There are news cameras focused on them. They get to say their names. People get to know who they are as they are holding elected office. And as they are sort of, in that moment of their political careers, they get up there and they associate themselves with, this is wrong. This shouldn't be allowed to happen. At the same time, people like former Republican State Assemblyman Van Tran, for my story, told me, it's going to take more than just a fancy press conference to actually change things. So what you've seen, for example, over the last year, when it came to the George Floyd protests, people were calling for, the same thing, action, not words. How do we actually change Orange County? And what came up at that time was some people were calling for an ethnic studies mandate in some school districts like Santa Ana Unified. Sort of, if you have a long-term vision for fixing this issue, these are some ways to do it. And through to go back to the George Floyd thing, was a lot of people across the U.S., not just in Orange County, but also in Orange County, were calling for reinvesting of public spending away from police and into community programs. You know, what can we do in that sort of vein to counteract discrimination against Asian Americans? You know, and we will see probably in the coming years, maybe even after the pandemic is over, likely the issue of Asian American discrimination and hate toward the API community persists, we'll probably see more of those conversations come up. Can we create a task force to address this issue? What kind of task force will that be? At what level of government will that be? Will it be city government? Will it be county government? What kind of programs in law enforcement can we invest in to sort of counteract hate toward AAPI? What kind of ethnic studies program can we mandate that's specifically tailored to also addressing hate toward AAPI, to teach that to our young children at an early age, you know, that this is a problem? So you'll probably see things like that come up in the time to come as this issue persists and as people continue to call it out.
Well, you know, you're mentioning law enforcement and like required curriculum. That I'm wondering if there's maybe a more of a soft power strategy, like what places of worship could push out, what kinds of media. I mean, Voice of OC, all of you are doing amazing work and putting lots of things that would be missed on our radar in allegedly a media desert here in Orange County. I keep repeating 3.3 million people that reside here. So I'm just wanting softer power in those other kinds of places, nonprofits, churches, places of worship, that kind of thing. There was the Southeast Asian American Oral History Project that was installed at the Santa Ana City Hall. I don't know if you were in school then or if you remember when that was there. That was kind of a come together. I don't know if that following was a broad enough one. So all these soft power opportunities, what do you think is a better bet?
Well, I mean, I won't speculate specifically on in terms of, you know, what my opinion is, but there's definitely, you know, opportunities for addressing hate toward AAPI through sort of what you just mentioned, through, you know, a diversification, probably some would say a diversification of community centers to make the AAPI community more visible. I mean, in Santa Ana last year in the elections, we saw the first Vietnamese American woman elected to the city council overseeing one of the United States' most densest metropolitan areas. And that area, it's not like that area became predominantly Vietnamese American overnight. It, you know, it's been like that for years. The West End, what I'm talking about specifically, as you go more into the Little Saigon area, as West Santa Ana kisses that area. So yeah, I mean, from a representation standpoint, you could also say, some might argue that that would also counteract feelings of resentment toward AAPI. You know, are we going to see more Thai Viet fans? I'm sorry, I probably should have mentioned her name. Her name's Thai Viet Phan. She sits on the Santa Ana City Council now. Will there be more people like her stepping up into a larger civic role in reaction to what's going on now? That'll be interesting to see. I'm very interested to see if we see sort of that chemical reaction.
For those of you who've just joined us, my guest is Brandon Foe, Voice of OC reporter. And he's talking about the recent article he filed with the Voice of OC talking about the hate crimes, the hate factor.
Hate overall, hate in general.
Hard-baked antipathy toward Asian American Pacific Islanders in Orange County. So did you happen to see the Southeast Asian American Oral History Project in Santa Ana when it was?
No, I have not.
So, and then how about what Kim Nguyen, is there something in her, she's trying to cross over with other groups. Does she have a special brand of leadership that might be sort of persuasive to bridge some of the sort of ethnic gaps in Orange County?
You're talking about Kim Nguyen in Garden Grove?
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to whether or not, you know, she's special, but because certainly there are other young Asian Americans who are growing into roles of leadership across Orange County, like Thai Viet Phan. You know, younger Asian American political leaders who are stepping into these roles, you know, after what we saw with first generation Vietnamese Americans like Van Tran. And so it's definitely, you know, safe to assume that we'll be seeing more people like them and that they will be able to connect with other young people who sort of fall into their age groups. I think age is a huge factor when it comes to social, the role of
social influence.
Yeah, social influence and sort of the role of that dynamic in influencing quality of life and government. You know, when you have people who are actually able to connect with young people in a way that, you know, hasn't happened before, I think that will definitely have an effect on, you know, what gets done in those communities.
So not everybody was aware. There was a member of the Democratic Central Committee in Orange County, Jeff Letourneau, who had expressed in a positive way, Ho Chi Minh in Orange County. It created a narrative that really, I don't know how to capture what it was sort of the Rorschach drawing, depending on what community you would identify with, but it was very problematic. Did you recognize when that first was uttered, his comments about Ho Chi Minh, the leader of Northern Vietnam, but how did you see that unfolding, that story, and how that had an effect on the kind of, let's say, the political mobilizing going into the general election last fall?
Right. Well, I think what happened with Jeff Letourneau and the Democratic Party of Orange County is a fascinating microcosm for what we're seeing on a larger scale, manifesting in other ways kind of across the U.S. when it comes to this argument of where Asian Americans, not just Vietnamese Americans, stand and their role in affecting elections when, you know, this group is so dynamic and so varied in terms of its interests. So what happened with Jeff Letourneau was his repost, it wasn't his post, he shared it, a post praising Ho Chi Minh for fighting against and freeing Vietnam from colonial forces, like the perceived colonial forces like the United States, sort of mirrors kind of the sentiment of young, more further left-leaning progressives who are becoming more vocal as, you know, they get older and they start to understand more about politics. I mean, young Vietnamese Americans like Tracy Law of Viet Rise sort of fall under that sort of, not classification or category, but, you know, political thinking is, you know, they want to see more progress, more benefits to, and more investment in their communities. And, you know, what Jeff Letourneau said sparked a lot of uproar in different ways across different age groups of the Vietnamese American community. So with first generation Vietnamese Americans with direct memories of fleeing Saigon, or what's now known as Ho Chi Minh in the 70s, who are traumatized by this war and the way their families were affected, to see praise of Ho Chi Minh, who was associated with all of that that went down in the 70s and before, that caused a lot of anger among elected officials like Janet Nguyen in the Republican Party. She wasn't elected back then, but, you know, she called it out on social media and she challenged the Democratic Party to correct that narrative for this portion of the Vietnamese American demographic that would be incensed by a statement like that. On the other hand, you did have people like Law in Viet Rise who went, okay, yes, people were traumatized by the war, but don't reduce us to this pro-communist versus anti-communist dichotomy. We're more than just this political argument that took place at the time during the war. You know, we're an actual American community with vibrant, with dynamic sort of qualities and real quality of life issues that are facing us, like housing and stuff. So at the same time, you had that group. And so what happened with the Letourneau process is, with the Letourneau situation, is it encapsulated complex and varied nature of the way the Vietnamese American community reacts to the way, in turn, political leaders view them as a constituency. So what happened after the post was Democratic Party of Orange County quickly convened a press conference at a Vietnam War Memorial Park in Westminster, and they basically spent, I don't remember if it was 30 minutes or an hour, but they spent a long time denouncing Letourneau and his remarks, speaking to that demographic of the Vietnamese American community that would be outraged by praise for Ho Chi Minh. But that outrage, or the way that praise for Ho Chi Minh impacts Vietnamese Americans, is different. It's not just that, you can't assume that they're all going to be angry at that, that they'll all be as incensed, or that it will ring or trigger these hyper-political feelings. I mean, to second and third and later generations of Vietnamese Americans, you know, they don't really feel, generational trauma exists, but it impacts them differently. So what happened at the press conference was everybody denounced Letourneau. They shouted freedom and democracy for Vietnam like three times or something. And basically they sent that message that they wanted to correct the misperception that his post means that Democrats associate themselves with communism or socialism, which it's that association that some would say, or some would argue, inclined Vietnamese Americans, many of them, to the GOP in the first place. And so you have all of that sort of, you have this whole complex dynamic playing out right here in Westminster because of one social media post.
Yeah, I mean, nuance gets sort of outplayed by red meat. And that, I think that's what I was thinking of with the kind of Rorschach drawing situation. But
right.
This way forward, as a last question to you, Brandon, I really thank you for your time today. I want to keep this sort of in front for people to be their best cosmopolitan selves. What kind of a teaching tool, a teachable moment do you take from the sort of end, the denouement of the general election last fall, and the kind of the vitriol still directed at Asian American Pacific Islanders in Orange County.
Right. Well, first of all, you can't apply this umbrella categorization for this interest group, because when you're talking about Asian Americans in general, that becomes problematic. When you are really talking about a subgroup like Korean Americans or Chinese Americans without really knowing it, right? So it's that, first of all. And then second of all, is assuming which way this overall demographic, or, you know, the different subgroups will vote. You know, some would argue that the Vietnamese American community, a lot of people assumed that they would be repelled by Trump's rhetoric toward immigration, because many Vietnamese Americans are immigrants themselves. But what you saw with the last elections in Little Saigon specifically, that area's representative seats at the county, state, and federal level largely saw Republicans elected. So that came kind of counteract to what some people would have assumed. So I think those two things are just vital to understanding and not making the same mistake about this fast-growing non-white demographic right here in the region.
So Andy, is there anything you want to say about your own, what you've encountered as an individual?
My dad and that side of my family, they actually fled Saigon right as it fell. And they went to Westfield, Massachusetts, where the local church helped them get a house. And they were the textbook first generation immigrant experience. And growing up, my dad, you know, he tried teaching me Vietnamese as a little kid. And then as I grew older, you know, I didn't really grow up around other Vietnamese Americans or other Asian Americans at all, for that matter. So as a kid growing up, I wasn't pressing my dad to teach me about, you know, Vietnam or how to speak Vietnamese. And I had sort of that experience that a lot of later generation people in immigrant families, you know, have, is where they're sort of disconnected from their homeland, where you see this with Latinos too, is, you know, their parents don't teach them Spanish. You know, you're American, speak English. It wasn't necessarily my dad's attitude, but I mean, along the same vein, right? So that's an interesting little tidbit about myself, is, you know, the complex ways the immigrant experience in general in the United States can manifest. It definitely manifested, you know, in my own life story.
So you were in Westfield, or you were raised mainly in Orange County?
I was born in Westfield, Massachusetts, and we lived sort of all over the U.S. And it was the, I guess, the primordial grip of my Vietnamese American, or my Vietnamese heritage, that brought us to Orange County, which is home to one of the largest Little Saigons. So, we eventually ended up here.
Well, I thank you for taking the time and from your busy journalistic schedule. And I hope, Brandon, you're going to keep me on a speed dial, so different things. So, and I'm always wanting to give Voice of OC any kind of visibility I can offer, because I learn so much. And this is, yes, folks, this is a definite pitch for, if you don't want news, then don't pay for it. If you want news, you have to pay for it. And so it's helping out Voice of OC. Well, thank you so much, Brandon, for being on Ask a Leader today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
My guest is Brandon Foe, Voice of OC reporter, today talking about his article that he recently published, Wave of Hate Toward Asian Americans Over Coronavirus, and one could argue other bases for xenophobia. Well, that's my wrap. Next week's show will be the Metropolitan Water District Women's Union rep again, Ellen Mackey, and tradeswoman Gina Chavez. Lots of movement since our recent time together. Talk with you next week. Thank you for listening, everyone. Masks. You know the drill.